36 years ago this month, more than 20,000 women gathered in Houston for the National Women's Conference, an event created by President Ford's executive order a few years before. The goal was to determine policy on issues from equal pay to child care funding to reproductive rights. The big conference followed a series of smaller ones in each state designed to help establish the topics for the national conference.
In many ways, it was a culmination of lots of things that had been happening for about 10 years. I also think that it was a sign of things to come and the beginnings of a very different political culture in our society and one that we're still living with.
The Equal Rights Amendment, of course, was a hot, very, it would lead the nightly news, the discussion about that. And at that point, did it not seem to a lot of people that the Equal Rights Amendment was well on its way to being adopted? I mean, it had gone through the Senate and the House with relative ease, had the support of President Nixon and Republican Spiro Agnew, George Wallace?
George Wallace, too.
Okay. How did this...
Yes. I mean, the ERA goes all the way back to 1923 when it was introduced by Alice Paul and the Women's Party. But feminists themselves were very divided on it for, you know, decades. And but finally, it came to the point in the early 70s where pretty much all women's organizations that were progressive in nature, venerable ones like the League of Women Voters and the AAUW and the BPW, as well as the new feminist organizations like NOW that had recently been created, everyone was unified on it. And in the early 70s, this was a period in which the women's movement just had tremendous support in Congress from both Democrats and Republicans, where the Nixon administration, the Congress, and the Supreme Court were all handing down victories to the women's movement. It seemed virtually unstoppable. Congresswoman Martha Griffiths was quoted, I believe, in 1970 as saying, "The revolution is over and has been won. The rest is a mopping up operation." And in the 72 Congress, there were more women's rights bills passed, I believe, than at any other time. But nothing so symbolized the widespread support for the women's movement and the sense among politicians that the American public supported it as that overwhelming victory of the ERA in 1972 in Congress. There were very few people that voted against it. And afterwards, the states were scrambling to be the first to ratify. And, you know, it sailed through with many ratifications during the next year and then many more the next year. And by 1975, only four more were needed. Little did people realize that only one more victory would come. And that was Indiana in January of 77. So at the time of the Houston conference, feminists were concerned. They were still hopeful, and there were fights going on in the 15 unratified states, as they were called. But people were worried, and Phyllis Schlafly and the ERA critics saw the IWI as just an effort to get it through. Schlafly loved alliteration, loves alliteration. She's very much part of the political scene today. She said that it was a federally funded festival for frustrated feminists.
She galvanizes this effort. It becomes very powerful. But she is able to become, through she and her supporters, become influential in some of the state conferences.
Yes.
And there's quite a bit of controversy and acrimony at these leading up to the International Women's Year Conference in Houston.
Exactly. Those are where the real fight took place by Houston. The delegates had already been elected, and it was more like carrying out a course that everyone sort of knew was going to happen. But what had happened was that the International Women's Year Commission was first created back in 1974 by President Ford. It was supposed to coordinate U.S. participation in the UN-sponsored International Women's Year program and a major conference in Mexico City. So they did coordinate that, but they were also charged by Ford with coming up for recommendations for how to make this a more perfect union and a better society for women. And so they were engaged. They did produce a massive, well-researched report. But after that conference in Mexico City, Bella Abzug and a number of others said, we need a conference that's a grassroots conference that gives the women of the nation an opportunity to help write these themselves. And they really believed, again, as I said, that it would help to expand the movement. But by that time, Schlafly believed that they had largely stopped the ERA bandwagon. And so they were furious when the federal government, when Congress gives $5 million to have these conferences to gain women's advice, and also the president had appointed feminists to lead it. And then, of course, Jimmy Carter inherits this program, and he appoints Bella Abzug herself to lead it. And she's perceived as by Schlafly and others as an arch enemy and one of the most radical feminists. She wasn't, but she was perceived that way. And so they were very angry that these conferences were even being held. They believed that they were quite right that the anti-ERA people were shut out of the leadership positions of this, a few tokens here and there on the state organizing groups. And so they regarded this as yet another example of federal government taking one side of a national debate.
And then when Houston happens, you have the conference that was expected. Phyl Schlafly has her own conference, not across the street, but almost.
Yes. But they had those showdowns, as you mentioned, at the state meetings. But the conservatives were only able to elect about 20% of the delegates to Houston. They had hearings in Congress that Jesse Helms, a key ally of Schlafly, sponsored to complain about these conferences being rigged and conservative women being shut down. And they only gained total control of a few of them. But what they were still trying to do was to get it shut down, to stop the program before the Houston conference ever happened. But when by the end of the summer it was clear that it was going forth, and they knew that because of all the battles that summer at the state conference that the press would be there in huge numbers, they said, okay, we are going to take this opportunity to try to have our message shown. We can't do it through the Houston conference and our 20% delegates. So they started organizing a lot of their people who had shown up for the state conferences and more, come to Houston. We're going to have a massive pro-life, pro-family rally, and we are going to send a message to the nation that IWY conference does not speak for us.
It's pretty interesting because it seems for a couple of decades, every time Phyl Schlafly kind of has a defeat, she gets stronger. She's a very good organizer.
She was a brilliant organizer. As I said earlier, I don't think that this could have been done without her. I don't think it would have been done without her. I think even the conservative men earlier in the decade thought she was on a wild goose chase. Of course, a lot of them tried then hard to help her succeed once it was happening. But I think what happened was that the new right strategists who were wanting to exploit social issues, nonetheless, they saw from her how you actually put together a movement of social conservatives. Because a lot of the people who were social conservatives were in groups that didn't get along with each other. You have Roman Catholics, you have Mormons, you have Southern Baptist and evangelical and fundamentalist churches that were not even very political. And she somehow managed to put together all of these into a smooth, united coalition against feminism and federally funded feminism. And they took note, and they saw that she could get that by working in opposition to feminism, embracing the title pro-family movement, that they could put together a very strong and politically powerful coalition. And I guess what I'm saying is she showed them the way to do that.
Is it fair to say that social conservative movements that are strong now owe a political debt to that period?
Yes, I think that they have their basis in that period. What's striking to me is that in the early 70s that the two parties were on the same side on large – there were differences. But both Republicans and Democrats at the national level had feminists who were active and strong within their parties. Men even like Nixon felt obliged to cater to them. Ford, I believe, was more genuinely supportive, and his wife very supportive. But by 1980 – what had happened was that this massive movement against the ERA during the IWI, which I think is a transformative event, turns into an enduring social movement that then working together with the new right, who saw how they could work with Schlafly to gain more control within the Republican Party, and that what happened is that the two parties choose up sides, in other words, with the decade, with the Democrats continuing to support feminism, sometimes cautiously, and the Republican Party deciding that they are going to become the pro-family party, that they dropped at the 1980 Republican National Convention. The party had been supporting the Equal Rights Amendment for 40 years. And they dropped it from their platform, and they also made it a strong pro-life platform. What I'm arguing in the book that I'm working on now is that these great debates over women's rights during the 70s, when women on both sides of the issue about what the federal government's policies ought to be took this very seriously. They were essentially looking at how should our society and our government change its policies to go along with the massive social and economic changes that had been taking place. So they knew that how the government responded was going to be important. Was the government going to try to reinforce the old ways and buttress them? Or was it going to retrofit to fit the new conditions? And it was a very important debate. It was trivialized by the press as, you know, a catfight, which the feminists and the conservatives both hated that because they knew what they were talking about was really quite serious. And but as the personal becomes political and these issues that were very laden with religious and moral significance are pushed to the forefront of our political debate, the public and the politicians are finding this compromise much more difficult, and indeed it becomes a dirty word. And compromise is less acceptable to either side because the issues are seen as moral issues. And so you add – so the country's being polarized like that. And then you add to that the fact that the two parties choose up sides. And so you end up in 1980 with a society that's not only highly polarized – but bitterly partisan. And a lot of the bitter partisanship comes because people feel like their people on the other side are morally suspect.
I think one of the fascinating things about being a historian is being able to peel back the layers, you know, with 40 years of hindsight, because certainly not many people in from 1975 to 1977 thought that no matter how loud this debate was and no matter how angry people were with each other, that it would have serious tentacles that would reach in well into now the 21st century.
Yes, I think you're right. I think that the 1980 election was a big shock to a lot of people who didn't think that was going to happen, and they did not see the major right turn coming to the extent that it came, or that it would endure as long as it has, and that the society would remain bitterly polarized as it remains to this day. So I think you're right. I think a lot of people were very surprised at the emergence of these developments.
Marjorie Sproul is a professor of history at the University of South Carolina. She was on the University of Arkansas campus this month to speak at a symposium sponsored by the Diane D. Blair Center of Southern Politics and the University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service. She spoke with Ozarks at Largest Kyle Kellums during her visit to Northwest Arkansas.